Okay, he said and put the mop away. There's a certain knack to it. You'll master it. Concentrating, he saw before him cracks in the enamel of the basin. He dribbled cleaner down into the cracks and ran hot water. The steam rose, and he stood within it, unmoving, as the steam grew. He liked the smell. After lunch, he sat in the lounge, drinking coffee. No one spoke to him, because they understood he was withdrawing. Sitting, drinking from his cup, he could hear their conversation. They all knew one another. If you could see out from inside a dead person, you could still see, but you couldn't operate the eye muscles, so you couldn't focus. You couldn't turn your head or your eyeballs. All you could do would be wait until some object passed by. You'd be frozen. Just wait and wait. Oh, that'd be a terrible scene. He gazed down at the steam of his coffee, only that. The steam rose. He liked the smell. Hey. A hand touched him, from a woman. Hey. He looked sideways a little. How you doing? Okay, he said. Feel any better? I feel okay, he said. He watched his coffee in the steam and did not look at her or any of them. He looked down and down at the coffee. He liked the warmth of the smell. You could see somebody when they passed by directly in front of you, and only then. Or whichever way you were looking, no other. If a leaf or something floated over your eye, that'd be it, forever. Only the leaf. Nothing more. You couldn't turn. Okay, he said, holding the coffee, the cup, with both his hands. Imagine being sentient, but not alive. Seeing and even knowing, but not alive. Just looking out. Recognizing, but not being alive. A person can die and still go on. Sometimes what looks out at you from a person's eyes maybe died back in childhood. What's dead in there still looks out. It's not just the body looking at you with nothing in it. There's still something in there, but it died, and it just keeps on looking and looking. It can't stop looking. Another person said, that's what it means to die, not to be able to stop looking at whatever's in front of you. Some darn thing placed directly there with nothing you can do about it, such as selecting anything or changing anything. You can only accept what's put there as it is. Why'd you like to gaze at a beer can throughout eternity? It might not be so bad. There'd be nothing to fear. Before dinner, which was served to them in the dining room, they had concept time. Several concepts were put on the blackboard by different staff members and discussed. He sat with his hands folded in his lap, watching the floor and listening to the big coffee urn heating up. It went whoop, whoop, and the sound frightened him. Living and unliving things are exchanging properties. Seated here and there on folding chairs, everyone discussed that. They seemed familiar with the concept. Evidently, these were parts of New Path's way of thought, perhaps even memorized and then thought about again and again. Whoop, whoop. The drive of unliving things is stronger than the drive of living things. They talked about that. Whoop, whoop. The noise of the coffee urn got louder and louder and scared him more, but he did not move or look. He sat where he was, listening. It was hard to hear what they were saying, because of the urn. We are incorporating too much unliving drive within us, and exchanging... Will somebody go look at that damn coffee pot to see why it's doing that? There was a break while someone examined the coffee urn. He sat staring down, waiting. I'll write this again. We are exchanging too much passive life for the reality outside us. They discussed that. The coffee urn became silent, and they trooped over to get coffee. Don't you want some coffee? A voice behind him, touching him. Ned? Bruce? What's his name, Bruce? Okay. He got up and followed them to the coffee urn. He waited his turn. They watched as he put cream and sugar into his cup. They watched him return to his chair, the same one. He made certain he found it again, to reseat himself and go on listening. The warm coffee, its steam, made him feel good. Activity does not necessarily mean life. Quasars are active, and a monk meditating is not inanimate. He sat looking at the empty cup. It was a china mug. Turning it over, he discovered printing on the bottom and cracked glaze. The mug looked old, but it had been made in Detroit. Motion that is circular is the deadest form of the universe. Another voice said, "Time." He knew the answer to that. Time is round. "Yes, we've got to break now, but does anyone have a fast final comment?" "Well, following the line of least resistance, that's the rule of survival. Following, not leading." Another voice, older, said, "Yes, the followers survive the leader, like with Christ, not vice versa." "We'd better eat because Rick stopped serving exactly at 5:50 now." "Talk about that in the game, not now." Chairs squeaked, creaked. He rose too, carried the old mug to the tray of others, and joined them in line out. He could smell cold clothes around him. Good smells, but cold. "Well, it sounds like they're saying passive life is good," he thought. "But there is no such thing as passive life. Well, that's a contradiction." He wondered what life was, what it meant. Maybe he did not understand. A huge bunch of donated flashy clothes had arrived. Several people stood with armfuls, and some had put shirts on, trying them out and getting approval. "Hey, Mike, you're a sharp dude." In the middle of the lounge stood a short, stocky man with curly hair and pug face. He shifted his belt, frowning. "But how do you work this hair? I don't see how you get it to stay. Why doesn't it loosen?" He had a 3-inch buckleless belt with metal rings, and he did not know how to cinch the rings. Glancing around, eyes twinkling, he said, "I think they gave me one nobody else could work." Bruce went over behind him, reached around him, and cinched the belt loop back through the rings. "Thanks," Mike said. He sorted through several dress shirts, lips pursed. To Bruce, he said, "When I get married, I'm going to wear one of these."
"Nice," he said.
Mike strolled toward two women at the far end of the lounge. They smiled. Holding a burgundy floral shirt up against himself, Mike said, "I'm going out in the town." "All right, go in and get dinner," the house director yelled briskly in his powerful voice. He winked at Bruce. "How you doing, fella?"
"Fine,"
Bruce said. "Sound like you got a cold."
"Yes," he agreed. "It's from coming off. Could I have any Dristan or..."
"No chemicals," the house director said. "Nothing. Hurry on in and eat. How's your appetite?"
"Better," he said, following.
They smiled at him from tables. After dinner, he sat halfway up the wide stairs to the second floor. No one spoke to him. A conference was taking place. He sat there until it finished. Everyone emerged, filling the hall. He felt them seeing him, and maybe some spoke to him. He sat on the stairs, hunched over, his arms wrapped around him, seeing and seeing, the dark carpet before his eyes. Presently, no more voices.
"Bruce."
He did not stir.
"Bruce."
A hand touched him. He said nothing.
"Bruce, come on into the lounge. You're supposed to be in your room at bed, but see, I want to talk to you."
Mike led him by waving him to follow. He accompanied Mike down the stairs and into the lounge, which was empty. When they were in the lounge, Mike shut the door. Seating himself in a deep chair, Mike indicated for him to sit down facing him. Mike appeared tired. His small eyes were ringed, and he rubbed his forehead.
"I've been up since 5:30 this morning," Mike said.
A knock. The door started to open. Very loudly, Mike yelled,
"I want nobody to come in here. We're talking, hear?"
Mumbles, the door shut.
"You know, you better change your shirt a couple of times a day," Mike said. "You're sweating something fierce."
He nodded.
"What part of the state are you from?"
He said nothing.
You come to me from now on when you feel this bad. I went through the same thing about a year and a half ago. They used to drive me around in cars. Different staff members. You met Eddie, the tall, thin drink of water that puts down everybody? He drove me for 8 days, around and around. Never left me alone. Mike yelled suddenly.
Will you get out of here? We're in here talking. Go watch the TV.
His voice sank and he eyed Bruce. Sometimes you gotta do that. Never leave someone alone.
I see, Bruce said.
Bruce, be careful you don't take your own life.
Yes, sir, Bruce said, staring down.
Don't call me sir.
He nodded.
Were you in the service, Bruce? Is that what it was? You got on the stuff in the service?
No.
You shoot it or drop it?
He made no sound.
Sir, Mike said. I've served myself 10 years in prison. One time I saw 8 guys in our row of cells cut their throats in one day. We slept with our feet in the toilet. Our cells were that small. That's what prison is. You sleep with your feet in the toilet. You never been in prison, have you?
No, he said.
But on the other hand, I saw prisoners 80 years old, still happy to be alive and wanting to stay alive. I remember when I was on dope, and I shot it. I started shooting when I was in my teens. I never did anything else. I shot up, and then I went in for 10 years. I shot up so much heroin and D together that I never did anything else. I never saw anything else. Now I'm off it, and I'm out of prison, and I'm here. You know what I noticed the most? You know what the big difference is I notice? Now I can walk down the street outside and see something. I can hear water when we visit the forest. You'll see our other facilities later on, farms and so forth. I can walk down the street, the ordinary street, and see the little dogs and cats. I never saw them before. All I saw was dope.
He examined his wristwatch.
So, he added, I understand how you feel.
It's hard, Bruce said, getting off.
Everybody here got off. Of course, some go back on. If you left here, you'd go back on. You know that.
He nodded.
No person in this place has had an easy life. I'm not saying your life's been easy. Eddie would. He'd tell you that your troubles are Mickey Mouse. Nobody's troubles are Mickey Mouse. I see how bad you feel, but I felt that way once. Now, I feel a lot better. Who's your roommate?
John.
Oh, yeah, John. Then you must be down the basement.
I like it, he said.
Yeah, it's warm there. You probably get cold a lot. Most of us do, and I remember I did. I shook all the time and crapped in my pants. Well, I tell you, you won't have to go through this again if you stay here at New Path.
How long? He said.
The rest of your life.
Bruce raised his head.
I can't leave, Mike said. I'd get back on dope if I went out there. I got too many buddies outside. I'd be back in the corner again, dealing and shooting, then back in prison for 20 years. You know, hey, I'm 35 years old. I'm getting married for the first time. Have you met Laura, my fiancée?
He wasn't sure.
Pretty girl, plump, nice figure.
He nodded.
She's afraid to go out that door. Someone has to go with her. We're going to the zoo. We're taking the executive director's little boy to the San Diego Zoo next week, and Laura's scared to death. More scared than I am.
Silence.
You heard me say that, Mike said. That I'm scared to go to the zoo?
Yes.
I never been to a zoo that I can recall, Mike said. What do you do at a zoo? Maybe you know.
Look into different cages and open confined areas.
What kind of animals do they have?
All kinds.
Wild ones, I guess. Normally wild. And exotical ones.
Well, at the San Diego Zoo, they have almost every wild animal, Bruce said.
They have one of those, what are they? Koala bears.
Yes.
I saw a commercial on TV, Mike said, with a koala bear in it. They hop. They resemble a stuffed toy.
Bruce said, the old teddy bear that kids have, that was created based on the koala bear back in the 20s.
Is that right? I guess you'd have to go to Australia to see a koala bear. Or are they extinct now?
Oh, there's plenty in Australia, Bruce said. But export is banned. Live or the hides, they almost got extinct.
I never been anywhere, Mike said, except when I ran stuff from Mexico up to Vancouver, British Columbia. I always took the same route, so I never saw anything. I just drove very fast to get it over with.
I drive one of the foundation cars. You know, if you feel like it, if you feel very bad, I'll drive you around. I'll drive, and we can talk. I don't mind.
Eddie and some others not here now did it for me. I don't mind.
Thank you.
Now, we both ought to hit the sec. Have they got you on the kitchen stuff in the morning yet? Setting tables and serving?
No.
Well, then you get to sleep to the same time I do. I'll see you at breakfast. You sit at the table with me, and I'll introduce you to Laura.
When are you getting married?
A month and a half. We'd be pleased if you were there. Of course, it'll be here at the building, so everyone will attend.
Thank you, he said.
He sat in the game, and they screamed at him, faces all over screaming. He gazed down.
You know what he is? A kissy facey!
One shriller voice made him peer up. Among the awful screaming distortions, one Chinese girl howling.
You're a kissy facey! That's what you are!
Can you fuck yourself? Can you fuck yourself? The others chanted at him, curled up in a circle on the floor. The executive director in red bell-bottoms and pink slippers smiled. Glittery little broken eyes, like a spook's. Rocking back and forth, his spindly legs tucked under him, without a pillow.
Let's see you fuck yourself!
The executive director seemed to enjoy it when his eyes saw something break. His eyes glinted and filled with mirth. Like a dramatic stage queer from some old court draped in flair, colorful, he peeped around and enjoyed. And then, from time to time, his voice warbled out, grating and monotonous, like a metal noise. A scraping mechanical hinge.
The kissy facey!
The Chinese girl howled at him. Beside her, another girl flapped her arms and bulged her cheeks. Plop, plop.
Here!
The Chinese girl howled, swiveled around to jut her rump at him, pointing to it and howling at him.
Kiss my ass then, kissy facey! He wants to kiss people! Kiss this, kissy facey! Let's see you fuck yourself,
the family chanted.
Jack yourself off, kissy facey!
He shut his eyes, but his ears still heard.
You pimp,
the executive director said slowly to him, monotonously.
You fuck. You dong. You shit. You turd prick. You on and on.
His ears still brought in sounds. But they blended. He glanced up once when he made out Mike's voice, audibly during a lull. Mike sat gazing at him impassively, a little reddened, his neck swollen in the too tight collar of his dress shirt.
Bruce, Mike said, what's the matter? What brought you here? What do you want to tell us? Can you tell us anything about yourself at all?
Pimp!
George screamed, bouncing up and down like a rubber ball.
What were you, pimp?
The Chinese girl leaped up, shrieking.
Tell us, you cock-sucking fairy whore pimp, you ass-kisser, you fuck.
He said, I am an eye.
You turd prick, the executive director said. You weakling, you puke, you suck off, you snatch.
He heard nothing now. And forgot the meaning of the words, and finally, the words themselves. Only, he sensed Mike watching him, watching and listening, hearing nothing. He did not know, he did not recall, he felt little, he felt bad, he wanted to leave. The vacuum in him grew, and he was actually a little glad. It was late in the day.
Look in here, a woman said, where we keep the freaks.
He felt frightened as she opened the door. The door fell aside and noise spilled out of the room, the size surprising him, but he saw many little children playing. That evening, he watched two older men feed the children milk and little foods, sitting in a separate small alcove near the kitchen. Rick, the cook, gave the two older men the children's food first, while everyone waited in the dining room. Smiling at him, a Chinese girl carrying plates to the dining room said,
"You like kids?"
"Yes," he said.
"You can sit with the kids and eat there with them."
"Oh," he said.
"You can feed them later on in like a month or two."
She hesitated.
"When we're positive you won't hit them. We have a rule. Children can't never be hit for anything they do."
"Okay," he said. He felt warmed into life, watching the children eat. He seated himself, and one of the smaller children crept up on his lap. He began spooning food to the child. Both he and the child felt, he thought, equally warm. The Chinese girl smiled at him, and then passed on with the plates to the dining room. For a long time, he sat among the children, holding first one and then another. The two older men quarreled with the children and criticized each other's way of feeding. Bits and hunks and smudges of food covered the table and floor. Startled, he realized that the children had been fed and were going off into their big playroom to watch cartoons on TV. Awkwardly, he bent down to clean up spilled food.
"No, that's not your job,"
one of the elderly men said sharply.
"I'm supposed to do that."
"Okay," he agreed, rising, bumping his head on the edge of the table. He held spilled food in his hand and he gazed at it, wonderingly.
"Go help clear the dining room,"
the other older man said to him. He had a slight speech impediment. One of the kitchen help, someone from the dishpan, said to him in passing,
"You need permission to sit with the kids."
He nodded, standing there, puzzled.
"That's for the old folk," the dishpan person said, "babysitting."
He laughed.
"They can't do nothing else."
He continued by. One child remained. She studied him, large-eyed, and said to him,
"What's your name?"
He answered nothing.
"I said, what's your name?"
Reaching cautiously, he touched a bit of beef on the table. It had cooled now, but aware of the child beside him, he still felt warm. He touched her on the head, briefly.
"My name is Thelma," the child said. "Did you forget your name?"
She patted him.
"If you forget your name, you can write it on your hand. Want me to show you how?"
She patted him again.
Won't it wash off?" he asked her. "You know, if you write it on your hand the first time you do anything, or take a bath, it'll wash off."
"Oh, I see," she nodded.
"Well, you could write it on the wall over your head, in your room where you sleep, up high where it won't wash off. And then when you want to know your name better, you can—"
"Thelma," he murmured.
"No, that's my name. You have to have a different name. And that's a girl's name."
"Let's see," he said, meditating.
"If I see you again, I'll give you a name," Thelma said. "I'll make one up for you, okay?"
"Well, don't you live here?" he said.
"Yes, but my mommy might leave. She's thinking about taking us, me and my brother, and leaving."
He nodded. Some of the warmth left him. All of a sudden, for no reason he could see, the child ran off.
"I should work out my own name, anyhow," he decided. "It's my responsibility."
He examined his hand and wondered why he was doing that. There was nothing to see.
"Bruce," he thought, "that's my name. But there ought to be better names than that," he thought.
The warmth that remained gradually departed, as had the child. He felt alone and strange and lost again, and not very happy.